Despite this, Congress was moving forward. The bill had been referred to five committees in Congress, three in the House and two in the Senate. The House Labor Committee voted out a health care bill in April that was actually more comprehensive than our bill. The other four committees were hard at work trying to forge consensus. There was a new element in Whitewater World as I got sued by Paula Jones. She had first appeared in public the previous February at the Conservative Political Action Committee convention in Washington, where she was introduced allegedly for the purpose of, quote, clearing her name. In David Brock's American Spectator article based on the allegations of the state troopers, one of their charges was that I had met with a woman in a Little Rock hotel who later told the trooper who had taken her to meet me that she wanted to be my, quote, regular girlfriend. Though she was identified in the article only as Paula, Jones claimed her family and friends recognized her when they read the article. She said she wanted to clear her name, but instead of suing the Spectator for libel, she accused me of sexually harassing her and said that she was denied the annual pay raises normally given to state employees. At the time, she was a clerical employee of the Arkansas Industrial Development Commission. Initially, Jones' debut didn't get much publicity, but on May 6, 2 days before the statute of limitations expired, she filed suit against me, seeking $700,000 for my alleged harassment. Before she filed the suit, Jones' first lawyer had made contact with a man I knew in Little Rock. The man got in touch with my office, telling us that the lawyer had said that her case was weak, and that if I would pay her $50,000 and help her and her husband Steve, who turned out to be a conservative Clinton hater, get jobs in Hollywood, she wouldn't sue me. I didn't pay, because I hadn't harassed her, and contrary to her other allegation, she had received her annual pay increases. Now I had to hire another lawyer to defend myself. The day after I returned from Europe to help commemorate the 50th anniversary of D-Day, Senator Kennedy's Labor and Human Resources Committee reported out a health care reform bill. It was the first time legislation providing universal coverage had ever made it out of a full congressional committee. One Republican, Jim Jeffords of Vermont, had voted for it. Jeffords encouraged me to keep reaching out to Republicans. He said that with a couple of amendments that wouldn't gut the bill, we could pick up a few more votes. Our euphoria was short-lived. 2 days later, Bob Dole, after having told me earlier that we would work out a compromise on the issue, announced that he would block any health care legislation and make my program a major issue in the November congressional elections. A few days later, Newt Gingrich was quoted as saying the Republican strategy was to make health care reform unpassable by voting against improving amendments. He was as good as his word. On June 30th, the House Ways and Means Committee voted out a universal coverage bill without a single Republican vote. The Republican leaders had received a memorandum from William Kristol, former chief of staff to Vice President Dan Quayle, urging them to kill health care reform. Kristol said the Republicans couldn't afford to allow anything to pass. A success on health care would present a, quote, serious political threat to the Republican Party, while its demise would be a, quote, monumental setback for the president. At the end of May, at a Memorial Day retreat, the Republican congressional leaders decided to adopt Kristol's position. I wasn't surprised that Gingrich would follow Kristol's hard line. His goal was to win the House and push the country to the right. Dole, on the other hand, was genuinely interested in health care and knew we needed to reform the system. But he was running for president. All he had to do was to hold 41 of his fellow Republicans for a filibuster, and we were sunk. On June the 21st, I transmitted to Congress a welfare reform bill designed by Health and Human Services Secretary Donna Shalala, White House staffer Bruce Reed, and their top-flight policy people to make welfare a second chance, not a way of life. The bill was the product of months of consultations with every affected interest group, from governors to people on welfare. The legislation required able-bodied people to go to work after 2 years on welfare, during which time the government would provide education and training. If there was no private sector job available, the welfare recipient would be required to take a government-subsidized one. Other provisions were designed to make sure recipients wouldn't be worse off economically in the workforce than they had been on welfare, including more money for child support enforcement and continuing health and nutritional coverage for a transition period under the Medicaid and food stamp programs. These changes, plus the large increase in the earned income tax credit for low-wage working families enacted in 1993, would be more than enough to make even low-wage jobs more attractive than welfare. Of course, if we passed health care reform, lower-income workers would have permanent, not just temporary, health coverage, and welfare reform would be even more successful. June brought the first real action from Robert Fisk. He had decided to conduct an independent inquiry into Vince Foster's death since so many questions had been raised about it in the media and by Republicans in Congress. I was glad Fisk was looking at it. The scandal machine was trying to get blood out of a turnip, and maybe this would shut them up and give Vince's family some relief. Fisk interviewed Hillary and me. It was a straightforward, professional session, and afterward I knew he would be thorough and believed he would finish his inquiry in a timely fashion. On June 30th, he issued preliminary findings on Vince's death, agreeing that it was a suicide, and finding no evidence that it had anything to do with Whitewater. From then on, Fisk was scorned by the conservative Republicans and their allies in the media. On the same day that Fisk issued his report, I drove another nail in my own coffin by signing the new independent counsel law. The law permitted Fisk to be reappointed, but the special division of the D.C. Court of Appeals could also remove him and appoint another prosecutor, starting the process all over again. Under the statute, the judges on the special division would be selected by Chief Justice Rehnquist, who had been an extremely conservative Republican activist before he came to the Supreme Court. In August, it gets hot in Washington, and Congress usually leaves town. In 1994, Congress stayed in session almost the entire month to deal with crime and health care. Both the Senate and the House passed versions of the crime bill, which provided 100,000 more community police, tougher penalties for repeat offenders, and more funds for both prison construction and prevention programs to keep young people out of trouble. When the conference committee met to resolve the differences between the Senate and House crime bills, the Democrats folded the assault weapons ban into the compromise bill. The ban had passed the House as a separate matter by only 2 votes in the face of furious opposition by the National Rifle Association. The NRA had already lost the fight to defeat the Brady Bill and was determined to prevail on this one so that Americans would retain their right to keep and bear rapid-fire, large magazine weapons designed for one purpose only, to kill a great many people in a hurry. These weapons worked. Crime victims shot with them were 3 times more likely to die than those whose assailants fired regular handguns. The conference decided to combine the ban with the crime bill because, while we had a clear majority for the ban in the Senate, we didn't have the 60 votes necessary to break a certain filibuster by NRA supporters. The Democrats in the conference knew it would be much harder to filibuster the overall crime bill than the assault weapons ban standing alone. The problem with the strategy was that it forced the House Democrats from rural pro-gun districts to vote on the assault weapons ban all over again, risking the failure of the whole bill and putting some of our caucus at risk of losing their seats if they voted for it. On August the 11th, the House defeated the new crime bill 225-210 on a procedural vote, with 58 Democrats voting against it and only 11 Republicans voting for it. 38 Republicans had voted for the assault weapons ban the first time, but Newt Gingrich pressured them back into line on this bill. A few of the Democratic no votes were liberals who opposed the bill's expansion of the death penalty, but most of our defectors were voting with the NRA. A sizable group of Republicans said they wanted to support the bill, including the assault weapons ban, but thought it spent too much money overall, especially on prevention programs. Now we were in trouble on one of my most important campaign commitments, and I had to do something to turn it around. The next day, before the National Association of Police Officers in Minneapolis, with the mayors of Minneapolis and St. Paul, Mayor Rudy Giuliani of New York, and Mayor Ed Rendell of Philadelphia, I tried to frame the choice as one between the police and the people on one side and the NRA on the other. Surely we had not reached the point where the only way to keep congressional seats safe was to have the American people and police officers in greater danger. Late in the month, the crime bill came to a vote again. Unlike health care, we were working on crime through good-faith bipartisan negotiations. And this time we won, 235-195, having picked up almost 20 Republican votes by negotiating a substantial cut in the costs of the bill. While we were winning on the crime bill, we kept on losing with health care. In early August, George Mitchell introduced a compromise bill to increase the percentage of the insured population to 95% without an employer mandate, leaving open the possibility of imposing one later to get to 100% if the bill's voluntary procedures didn't succeed in doing so. I announced my support for Mitchell's bill the next day, and we began to shop it to moderate Republicans, but it was no use. Dole was determined to defeat any meaningful reform. It was good politics. On the day the crime bill passed, the Senate recessed for 2 weeks with no further action on health care. The other big news in August was in the parallel world of Whitewater. After I signed the independent counsel statute, Chief Justice Rehnquist appointed Judge David Sintel to head the special division, which had responsibility for naming independent counsels under the new law. Sintel was an ultra-conservative protege of Senator Jesse Helms. The judge had decried the influence of, quote, leftist heretics who wanted America to become a, quote, collectivist, egalitarian, materialistic, race-conscious, hyper-secular, and socially permissive state.